Third case of the morning, United States v. Villalpando. Mr. Eisenberg.
Thank you. May it please the Court, my name is Mark Eisenberg. I represent Christopher Villalpando. This is really a fact-based issue, and I think it's important for us to understand what the standard of review should be. I do believe it should be a de novo review, both of the facts and of the conclusions, because you're in the same position as the magistrate was and the district court was to make the determination based on the transcript, which was the only evidence put in at the suppression hearing. And you can make the same inferences as the prior fact in this case. I think it's a unique position, and I think you should consider this de novo.
I don't think that it is so unique, actually. And the Supreme Court has never adopted that kind of test. Similar arguments have been made about cases that rest heavily on documents, for example, where the Court of Appeals is just as capable of reading the document as was the district court. And in a whole line of cases, I'm thinking of Pullman Standard against Swint, but there are many others, the court has nonetheless said that the district court is the finder of fact. There are certain efficiencies for that. There are certain expertise reasons. Sure, we can read the transcript. We have read the transcript. But I just am not aware of any authority from the Supreme Court that allows us to toss out the normal standard of review.
I'm not familiar with the cases you're referring to, Your Honor.
But the standard happened to be an employment case, but it was about that question. Are there some sorts of sources of information that the Court of Appeals can review with a, in a more de novo sense? And the Court has never drawn that line.
I think a transcript's different from documents in that the transcript is really a, it's the testimony without the witnesses.
Right.
So the trial judge, or in this case the magistrate, is not in any better position to judge credibility than you are.
Does it matter to you what the standard of review is?
Well, I think so, because he's already made some findings and conclusions that I think I disagree with some of his findings, and I'd like to present that to you.
So can you win only if our review is de novo on the facts?
I don't think so. I think I could still win the other way, too. The thrust of the government's argument and the court's decision is that this was really a negotiation in process, and that no promises had been made to Mr. Villalpando to get him to incriminate himself. And our government argument and the court decided that I took a lot of the statements out of context, and that to make my argument that this was a false promise of leniency. But I don't think I did. And I look back at this, and I start with the first, right after she reads the Miranda warnings to him, she says, I'm going to tell you what I'm going to charge you with. I'm going to charge you with possession of marijuana and driving without a license. Now, the court found that this was a savvy defendant who had been in the had experience with the system quite a bit. To him, this is Mickey Mouse, driving after revocation and 3 grams of marijuana. He says, if you're going to lock me up for that, go ahead. Sure, you'd have a probation hold. But in my experience of doing this for 27 years, I doubt he would have been revoked for 3 grams of marijuana, which is different than the court found.
You know, the thing is, though, if we really are going to look at this interview, Mr. Villalpando is constantly saying things that indicate he knows exactly what's going on. He says things like, you know, the PO makes the last decision. You guys don't make the decision about my probation. So she says, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he keeps saying things that suggest he knows exactly what's happening. I think this theory that she's leading him get down the garden path doesn't really hold up.
I don't disagree with you that he's savvy and knows what the system's about.
Well, and he's also saying she's not even promising enough. He complains that she's holding back.
Well, I disagree with you, and that's what I'm going to get at.
Well,
he doesn't trust her. That's what the bargaining is. He doesn't trust her, so he wants to talk more and make sure he knows exactly what she's going to do. And, you know, when she's making the charges, she never says, as she says later, oh, by the way, we know you've been dealing drugs for the last 10 days because we've had controlled buys from you. She never says that right then. She holds that and waits till later. And I'll talk about that in a minute.
Senator, if there's a lack of trust, why would you continue talking?
Because she continues to preach to him and get him to trust her. She continues. I want you to cooperate. She doesn't really say about what. We don't have to send charges to the district attorney. We can smooth this out with your probation agent. I'll have my boss call your boss. This is before he says anything. We need your help. It does nobody any good to have you locked up. Now, to me, that is the key part right there. Nobody does nobody any good to have you locked up. We'd like your help. He hesitates because he doesn't trust her. And he says, I don't care if you lock me up for this. She says, it's up to you, but we need your help, and we're going to get through to your PO right away. Now, what's the inference so far?
But she also says, I'm looking at page 21,
but that's
I need your help. I can't get to this other person without your help. I've been trying, she says. So it seems to me she's trying to get him to be a cooperating witness. That's why she wants him back in his apartment, so he'll be there to answer the phone.
But you're taking that out of context.
I don't think so. Because
this is after he...
You're inviting me to read this and find my own context.
But, I am, but that's after he incriminates himself. I'm still on before he says anything about the gun in his house. So one inference is to be drawn so far before he says anything about the gun. We'll keep you out of jail. We want your help. And we don't have to charge you. Now, she keeps telling him this, and he finally says, well, I got this gun and money. And what does she say right after that? I appreciate you being straight with me. Look how much progress we're making already. All you can do right now is put your trust in me. What's she saying? You're doing well. Keep it up. Trust me. I'll uphold my end of the bargain. And she actually says that on page 12. If we're going to have honesty in an honest relationship, it's got to be honest across the board. You're going to see how I hold up my end of the bargain. What's the bargain?
I'm going to say that it really sounds like a interrogation technique to me.
Okay.
This is how she communicates with this guy, who communicates back very well in the same way.
But remember what the standard is: a false promise of leniency. She's already said, "I'm not going to go to jail. You're not going to go to jail. I'm going to do everything I can with your PO so you don't have the hold, and it gets better."
If you cooperate.
Well, I mean, wait a minute. What does that mean?
That if you cooperate, she tells him. She says, "It's I want to get at these other people, but I can't get at."
I'll get to that in a second.
Well, as I said. Really want us to read this.
He keeps going. He's concerned because after she says, I'll uphold my end of the bargain, he still doesn't trust her. She says, page 10, I'll help you get your license. I want to keep you in school. It doesn't make me feel good to lock people up. I like people doing the right thing. If I see you in a year and say, hey, you tell me I got a job. I graduated from school. She said, wouldn't that be sweet? Well, what does that mean? That means, what's the inference? You're not going to jail. I'm going to keep you in school, and you're going to get your driver's license. She says, keep giving me the truth, and you're going to get out of this. And eventually, she says, you'll most likely walk away from this. He's still concerned, because he's not so sure he trusts her. She says, we need to be honest both ways. I read that part to you about the bargain. But the government has argued there was no bargain. They keep saying there was just negotiation back and forth. But I don't think that's true. He says, Denise, I'll help you if you help me. She says, I will. Page 13. Then we're still going into this trust thing. She continues, tell me how much coke you have in the house and how much money in the safe and the source. She says, we'll work all that out. And so he says, so if I give you what I got in there, is that all you want? She goes, yeah. Page 18. And he proceeds to do so. And she tells him later, you most likely will walk away from this. Now, what is that telling you? This starts right at the beginning. They say, oh, it's not till after he incriminates himself. But I don't think that's accurate. What does it mean? This isn't rocket scientist. This seals the deal. Government argues he incriminated himself with the gun in the safe, before the bargaining was completed. But I don't think so. You asked one question, Your Honor, about what the bargain was, the cooperation. The government has the burden of proof to show that this is a voluntary confession. They didn't put on any evidence to say he never cooperated at all at the hearing. And I think that is key. There's also an issue about inevitable discovery. I don't know if my light's on for a minute or not for rebuttal. But there was no proof, you know, the warrant that was issued, the search warrant, was all based on the statements, incriminating statements he gave. It didn't have anything to do with her saying, well, we bought drugs from you within the last 10 days. And she never said in those 10 days that they supposedly bought the drugs from him, that they were bought at his house. So I'd ask you to suppress everything. Thank you.
Mr. Eisenberg. Ms. Duschman.
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is Meredith Duschman, and I do represent the United States. In this case, I think there's a couple things to keep in mind before looking at the arguments raised by defendant this morning. I would ask the Court to keep in mind that all the statements here were post-Miranda. So before this conversation even gets going, the officer tells him point blank, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you tell me, I can use against you. The defendant also concedes he wasn't physically threatened. He wasn't intimidated. The duration or the style of the discussion between he and the officer wasn't unfairly coercive, and essentially admits, you know, this is a defendant who's been around the block a few times with the police. The defendant has alleged that he cooperated, and that really cuts to the heart of, I think, what the critical inquiry here, which is what was the supposed bargain? I mean, that's how you get to what does cooperation means. And what the defendant alleges here is that there was a clear bargain. He claims the officer basically promised him immunity if he would just tell her what he had in his apartment.
Is there any evidence in this record as to what happened after this conversation? Did Officer Markham ever communicate with the DA's office or the probation officer, or did Mr. Villalpando actually cooperate? Is there any evidence?
What is in the record is that Mr. Villalpando, the probation officer, put a hold on him anyway, and he was placed.
But we don't know if Officer Markham, you say anyway, so we know the probation officer put a hold on him. Do we know whether Officer Markham had any conversation with the probation officer, had any input into that decision?
We don't know. We do know that he was not charged with any additional crimes based on this. On the state side, we know that from the probation report. And I know, although it's not a matter of record, that the defendant never became a CI. I think one of the things to keep in mind is that really just from a common sense perspective, the bargain that the defendant proposes makes absolutely no sense. What officer is going to promise a person immunity if only they just tell them what they did wrong? Where does that get the police officer? Absolutely nowhere. Unless the defendant is going to provide further cooperation, the bargain the defendant claims the officer worked so hard to get is kind of silly, really. And beyond that, the district court found that the focus of the interview was plainly trying to get the defendant to give up his source and become a confidential informant.
Well, Ms. Duchamp, was the discussion about the potential violation of probation a deceptive detour? Is that set up, or is it a straw man? I don't know. It seems to me there's that initial dialogue which is really potentially irrelevant if we're going to end up with 70 months.
Well, I guess I would respectfully submit that it's neither one, Your Honor. And the reason for that is the defendant can't be a CI if he's on a probation hold. If he's going to cooperate and become a CI, quite frankly, the officer needs him not to be on a probation hold as much as the defendant doesn't want to be on one. And so the discussion about, you know, if you're going to cooperate, I'll try and talk to your probation officer, but I don't really know what he's going to do because I'm not familiar with him and you're not in a very good situation, but I'll see what I can do. Quite frankly, if she can't get the probation officer to agree, he can't be a CI. And so I don't think it was really either as much as it's part and parcel with what needs to happen in order for him to become a CI. He can't be on a probation hold sitting in jail because obviously nobody's going to sell to him if he's in jail. The other thing I kind of wanted to focus on was, in addition to the court finding that there was really no promises per se, and that it was really in the form of this negotiation back and forth between a savvy defendant and an experienced officer. The district court found also that these admissions that he made weren't really in reliance on any so-called promises, even if you were to characterize that. That they were this whole notion of what's in your apartment is sort of a piecemeal thing that goes on, as you can read through the transcript throughout, wasn't really the focus of the negotiation. It was sort of a side issue. The other thing that the defendant argues vigorously is that the officer promised him immunity because she needed the incriminating statements to get a warrant against him. Again, looking at that from a common sense perspective, what he is saying is that the officer has gone to all this trouble to stop the defendant, make promises of immunity specifically for the purpose of getting the guy to tell him what's in the apartment because she wants to do a search warrant when, if you believe him, she can't prosecute him for anything in there anyway.
But, you know, she does, right off the bat, one of the first things she says to him is, based on your cooperation, we have some discretion with the district attorney, they don't have to charge you. She's softening him up.
No doubt.
Right away.
Yes.
And implying that if he cooperates, that will go well for him.
Yes.
And then, you know, I guess the other fact is they do use the things that he tells her as part of the basis, in fact, as the basis for the search warrant. So maybe they hypothetically could have written up an affidavit for a search warrant without any of it, but we don't know that. All we know is that the actual affidavit supporting the warrant.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. There's some discussion in the record of controlled purchases from the defendant, as well as the fact that surveillance reports indicate he was coming from that residence when he had the marijuana. But you're absolutely right. When they went to write the warrant, I don't want to say they took the easy way out, but certainly, you know, defendant admitted this was in his apartment, was certainly the most expeditious way to go ahead and get the warrant. But truly, if all the defendant had to do was just simply say, hey, this is what's in my apartment, then why go to do the warrant? Why not just get him to consent and then let him go on about his way? I mean, all of these things don't make any common sense when you look at what would an officer be motivated by to strike the bargain that defendant suggests. The other thing that I think is critical here and that both the magistrate judge and the district court really focused on is that the defendant began incriminating himself before any of these so-called promises were made.
Well, that's why I mentioned the first thing.
Right.
I think he actually has already heard her say that before he starts incriminating himself. So I'm not sure the sequence works out.
Well, I respectfully submit that what the court is describing, this sort of early on, we want the people, we know who you know, we want you to cooperate, that sort
we
of thing.
We don't have to send charges up,
correct.
She says.
It, true. I would submit that certainly, you know, broaching the topic of cooperating, that's certainly buttering him up. But it's not a promise per se. And in fact, you know, his statement, I've got a gun and some money in my safe, is I think at pages 7 and 9 of the interview transcript. And the defendant is still complaining as late as page 31 of the transcript that the officer wasn't promising anything. He says, quote, you can't promise me I'm not going to jail. You can't promise me nothing. So this was well into this interview that he's still mad. She's not promising him anything. He knows the game, and he's mad. And he's also mad, and this is something that the magistrate judge and the district court noted as well. He's really angry that she's really using this stop as leverage against him. He knows the game, and he says, well, why didn't you just call me if you wanted me to cooperate? And she says, I think probably pretty cynically, well, gee, we don't usually have much luck calling people up and saying, we know you're a drug dealer, you mind giving us your source? We need leverage on people, and, you know, this is our leverage on you. And so I understand that the defendant wants to sort of recharacterize these very preliminary discussions, but the fact of the matter is, you know, on page 7, he's admitting that he's got a pistol in a safe. She knows that he is a felon, and as late as page 31, he's saying, you're not promising me anything. I just think it's very difficult for him to say that really that he made these incriminating statements in reliance on any promises when he's complaining the entire time she isn't making him any. The other thing is, and the defense attorney alluded to this, is the government has submitted, and so did the district court, that sort of in an attempt to bolster the claim, really what the defendant is doing is he kind of did a little bit of that here, and I certainly don't blame him because those are in fact words she spoke. But when you sort of string them together without what the defendant was saying in between, they're sort of taken out of context and sometimes out of order. I think if anything, the statements that the defendant continually says, "You're not promising him anything. Why can't you tell me you won't go to jail? Why don't you just do this for me?" says more than anybody. It was the defendant who knew he wasn't being misled by any promises that the officer made. That's what the district court found. We believe that was the correct finding, and we'd ask that the court affirm the judgment and sentence of the defendant.
Thank you, Ms. Fisherman. Ms. Reiser, your time had expired, but you may have a minute for rebuttal if you wish. All right. Obviously, our thanks to both counsel. Mr. Eisenberg, an additional thanks to you for accepting this appointment and ably representing the defendant on appeal. Case is taken under advisement.